The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Bollywood is for Lovers, part of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. I'm Aaron Fraser.
And I'm Matt Bose. In this special supplemental episode, we're joined by OK Computer creators Neil Pagadar and Pooja Shetty to discuss the genre-bending series that's now streaming on Hotstar.
Before we begin, we would like to respectfully acknowledge that we record this podcast on Treaty 6 territory, home of First Nations and Métis people.
All right, so we are speaking here with Neil Pagadar and Pooja Shetty, the creators of the new TV show, OK Computer. How are you two today? This evening? We're today. You're this evening.
Yeah, it's going great. It's all going good. We can't complain. It's been, I think, close to a month. 2 months since the show dropped. It's been unreal. We're still sort of, it's still sinking in. But yeah, can't complain. It's going well.
It's been like 2 months of lockdown also. It's actually been longer lockdown. Like we've done entire post in lockdowns. So, but it's a really weird feeling to have the release and post-release also in a lockdown. It's so apart from that, we're pretty good. We've gotten the hang of doing a lot of Zoom calls and Zoom interviews and Zoom hangouts and hangouts. So that's our life now.
Yeah, everyone has basically. But let's get straight right into it because something that we really liked about the show is, and you'll forgive me if I'm completely off the mark here, but I think I am on it, that I think you're presenting a pretty optimistic view of the future. There's some big challenges that humanity is dealing with, but other ones have been like taken care of. And especially right now, as things are pretty damn dark around the planet, you know, it was actually nice to see a show that was so hopeful. Was that intentional? Like, do you want to kind of fight against the depressing sci-fi? I'm thinking like Children of Men, right? Like just everything's gone to shit. Whereas this, you know, people are getting murdered every now and then and there's some agitation, but a lot of things are actually going okay, except for pineapples though.
Right.
It was a very conscious choice. One thing that we have hated for a very long time is how shows, cinema, some literature does a huge disservice to science because whatever, you know, our entire civilization, everything that we have right now is because of science and because of the progress and the march of technology and the progress that it's made to aid humanity. So we didn't want to cast science in a negative light. We didn't want to be anti-intellectual. We didn't want to be anti-science or anti-rational. We wanted that to triumph. But at the same time, we didn't want to be naive in the assumption that everything is going to be like, it's not everything is rose-colored, like tinted glasses. Mm-hmm. We be very aware that what the limitations are, what the biases are, what are the fallacies that we can sort of commit as a civilization? And that normally comes from, you know, corporations or from policy or from, you know, from institutions that do not really respond to things well. So we really wanted to address it in that way. We didn't want to stop technology, but we wanted to be aware, raise questions of mm-hmm. what that means and raise the ethics of it or raise the morality of it.
All artists, all humankind, all of humankind feels existential. We feel existential every day. But as writers and as thinkers and as creators, we feel like existentialism is a base reality for us. It's a baseline. Our job as creators is then to find meaning in things. And if that meaning doesn't exist in anything else, we create it. And if we're going to create meaning, if we're going to start from scratch, why shouldn't it be hopeful? Because life is nasty, brutish, and short anyway. So we consciously knew that we wanted to, and this is also our worldview. It's not something that we had to consciously attempt to manifest in the work, but it's really how we feel. It feels like we're as much as there's strife and despair and hopelessness, there's an equal number of positive outcomes that have resulted from years and years of civilization and progress, like Pooja is saying. Like just this past year has been a roller coaster, and somehow in a span of 11 months we have like what, 5 or 6 viable vaccines or probably more. So it's an extremely hopeful time, and like Pooja is saying, science has made that hope possible. So we constantly felt the responsibility of communicating that hope and wonder and awe that science and technology seem to create every day in labs or in research. We wanted to pass that wonder and that awe and sort of communicate it to the world at large.
Yeah, like you talk about the vaccines. I think I read that, I believe it was BioNTech, the Pfizer one. They actually sequenced, the Chinese sequenced the disease in like a day, and then they fed it into their computer, and in 2 days they actually had the vaccine figured out. It was just, now we have to test it out. But like the fact that a computer can do all that so quickly, and then it's up to us humans to be the control and figure out like the proof, that's just amazing to me. And the fact that they're looking at, you know, a malaria vaccine next and all these other things using this mRNA technology, we're on the brink of like a golden age in some respects. We just have to, you know, use our collective intelligence and, you know, work on some of these bigger problems. So that's why, you know, we'll see what you think of this one. I think that that your show is a post-cyberpunk work, because cyberpunk was so depressing and
nihilistic,
and corporations run everything. Whereas post-cyberpunk, like Snow Crash or Cory Doctorow's work, it's looking at that and saying, okay, well, what happens next? What happens when we have this high technology, but also morality behind it? What label do you attach to your own work? How do you describe this thing? Because there's a lot going on.
Yeah, where do you see it within science fiction, within the genre?
Oh, wow. Actually, for the longest time, I used to misdefine the word heterotopia. Mm. I used it as neither utopia nor dystopia, but you know, in the end, basically heterotopia is worlds that are that work in isolation, that works in like almost like, you know, that outside forces don't really react to, or it has its own rules, it has its own sort of character. I sort of imagine it, Asho, as that sort of that middle space, that which is reality, you know, which is, nothing is great, nothing is rose, nothing is like utopian, and nothing is so beautiful, and neither is it so dystopic. And that's where I think, you know, absurdism plays such a nice space into it, because it is nihilistic, it is existential, but in the end, because it's absurd, it has this ability to make fun of itself and you know, just throw this, I mean, because it's chaotic, right? Our world is chaotic, so there is no way of, you know, defining it or understanding it. So I feel like our show is also a bit in that space. It's absurd. It's maximalistic. It's too much on your senses. Mm-hmm. Is what I think the show would be in that sort of space. It's not one thing. It's, yeah, I don't know. Neil, how do you define
it's everything
it?
All at the same
yeah.
time?
Yeah, it's actually it's an expression of the Indian experience, really, because it's, if you've ever if you've ever been to India, and you guys are you know, you guys consume so much of Indian culture through film and through television, but it's just an accumulation of all kinds of things in Indian culture, and I feel like we wanted to capture that right from the get-go, because we were too tired of the dystopian idea of science fiction. And of course, we live in a dystopia as much as we live in a utopia. So just capturing the Indian reality already means that we're sort of encompassing its various absurdities, the daily idiosyncrasies that we encounter. And again, this is something that we used to discuss before we started writing. It's that all of this sort of the idea of capturing the Indian absurd experience came from the story of a mall parking lot. And the story goes that Pooja and I were driving to a suburban mall in Mumbai. We pulled up to the parking lot and we were stopped by this boom pole thing that you're supposed to stop at. And then they had installed these machines that would dispense a ticket so you could remember where you parked and how much you had to pay when you got out. But the powers that be from the mall decided that it was also prudent to install a life and blood human being right next to the machine, whose job it would be to press the button that would dispense the ticket and then simply meet the distance between the driver's outstretched hand and the machine itself. And they would have shifts, so every 3 hours there would be a change in shift. And it felt like this is such a great capsule of an absurd Indian experience. We're living in a time where we have really sophisticated technology, but in India we feel like that's not enough. We need to beat it up, we need to manipulate it, we need to appropriate it in a way that it finally suits our needs. So it's not enough to just to have the greatest AI and the greatest inventions at our disposal. It has to be changed. It has to be manipulated a little bit. So the show is a reflection of that. We were also talking the other day that if we had to find an equivalent in music, for example, what would the show be? Because it's had a bit of an overwhelming experience for a lot of people. It's made that happen in people where we've heard from a lot of people who even liked the show saying that, you know, it's a bit too much. It gets to be a little too much, but I liked it anyway. So it's like a few caffeine shots delivered in a matter of 2 hours. So we felt like if you've ever heard Sufjan Stevens' Age of Arts, which came out, I don't know, a decade ago or something. Or something like that. It feels like that's a great analogy for us in terms of music, because it's a completely maximalist, unapologetic, relentless, almost ruthless sort of assault on your senses. Mm-hmm. So we feel like ours is like a comedic rendition of that.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. I am always a fan of maximalism. I always want like more and more and more.
Yeah, if I had to pick a musical group, I would say the Avalanches. Do you know them?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think so.
They're sort of like Sufjan Stevens. They take forever to put out new music. I think they put out 2 albums in 15 years. And it was so much so that some of our younger friends didn't even know who they were. We're like, where were you? Oh, yeah, you were in junior high when that came out. Right? But they're an Australian group who do turntablism. And someone has tried to figure out every single sample that they've used. And it's almost impossible just because they've used like TV, movies, other songs. Oh. And they use it to just create these beautiful songs that have just been stuck in my head for 15 years. But if you were to distill it down, it would be, you know, so many little pieces that work together to make this whole. So, but talking about sort of influences, so I think we said this on the episode, but this has to be the Indian science fiction property we've seen that is most in conversation with Western sci-fi. Because, you know, we've seen things like Action Replay, which is a remake of Back to the Future.
Or
Raw One, which is kind of about video games, I guess. But Love Story 2050, which is just horrible. But even just watching this show, scene by scene, we were thinking of like, okay, well, this kind of reminds me of Mobius's work. And this kind of reminds me of Ghost in the Shell, or
which is not Western,
yeah,
Japanese.
But it's definitely not Indian though. Or the building that the corporation is in kind of reminds me of the Tyrell Corporation from Blade Runner. So, do you see yourself as being influenced by outside Indian sci-fi? Because we did.
Absolutely, yes. also it was a necessity when we started looking at, and also we've I mean, since as far as I can remember, as far back as I can remember, the both of us have been influenced by science fiction that was always from outside India. You know, whether it was Russian or American or even Japanese or Chinese more recently. So those influences were always with us. Isaac Asimov was a humongous influence on our early ideas, and that's how the Three Laws of Robotics also made its way into the show, because we felt like that was a common ground that we could all agree on or even disagree on. But we knew that was something that we needed to set up and maybe subvert later. So when we started researching this and while we were writing this, we quickly realized that there wasn't too much to fall back on in terms of Indian science fiction. There's been a considerable amount of Indian science fiction going back, you know, 5 or 6 decades. But it's always bordered on bordered on fantasy. They've always been works of fiction that were interspersed with myth and fantasy, and they were always sort of reimaginations of mythical Indian works. There would always be a god of death. There would always be talks of an afterlife. While that has been enchanting for a large part of the audience, we disagreed with the fundamental classification of a work like that as science fiction. We wanted to focus on the science part of it, and especially the hard science part of it, because that's what we grew up consuming. You know, whether it was Neal Stephenson or Brian Egan or Ursula K. Le Guin, we knew that communicating hard ideas of science was completely possible, even though those ideas might be 4 or 5 decades away from our present day. The influences were always non-Indian. There wasn't much to fall back on. There were works from Satyajit Ray, who's you know, regarded as the finest filmmaker from India. But again, those have constantly bordered on things that we couldn't digest as science fiction. They so often bothered on sort of leaps of faith within science fiction. We found it very hard to consume those as sort of ardent fans of science fiction. Going back, the most recent piece of science fiction that had any impact on our culture was Mr. India, which came out, I think, maybe 30 or 35 years ago. And there hasn't been much else. There's been a lot of campy, weird commercial stuff that has gone on in Bollywood in the last few years and decades. But there wasn't really any cinematic value in anything. We couldn't find any artistic or scientific integrity in anything that was coming out. So we, of course, had to rely upon the world. We had to look back and look ahead. And we knew that the three-body problem had come out of China. Black Panther, which is such a humongous property that has emerged from the comic book universe, so neatly was transposed into Afrofuturism. So we knew that it was possible to do this in India. We knew that we could sort of inherit works of science fiction heritage and appropriate them and reorient them for the Indian subcontinent.
So what you're saying is Krish is not sci-fi. Or what about Intheron? I mean, he's a robot. That's basically sci-fi. He's a bunch of robots.
Quaymagaya is supposedly based on a Ray story, but
yeah.
Yes.
So would you say that you guys are working in, like, you say Afrofuturism for a Black Panther? Are you guys working in the Indo-futurism space?
I mean, that's the attempt, you know, because for the longest time, like Neil was saying, that we've been consuming science fiction, you know, ideas and literature and films from outside. It almost becomes second nature for us to sort of continue that conversation. And most times what we forget when continuing this conversation is that India has sort of been left behind. You know, it's a conversation that's happening globally, but India doesn't have a seat on that table. So it was a really weird sort of moment for us that we had to realize that we couldn't just jump off something like Gattaca or Star Wars or 2001 A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. We have to establish our science fiction. We have to establish, you know, just the basics that Asimov had already established, you know, sort of take our audiences along with this new sort of world and then jump and join that conversation. So it became this very weird sort of feeling where we had to sort of cater to novices, and also we had to cater to professionals and like geeks. So it was that we were sort of very conflicted there. So it was always a sort of, you know, give and take that what do we keep, what do we not keep. Like for the longest time, so many people, like we mentioned Three Laws of Robotics because, again, it's the basis of, you know, AI and Asimov has done this. But a lot of people in India assume that we came up with that.
Yeah.
Not mentioning that, you know, it's the three laws itself have been like, you know, destructed just by Asimov himself. So it obviously doesn't work. So just that became quite a challenge for us. So making that new pop culture, you know, was both exciting and a task because we had to build, you know, everything from costumes to architecture to the way people talk to, you know, make everything but put it in Indian pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Which again, like, you know, like the references that you were saying, like Krish and all those guys, they just derive it from Western, film, and then they sort of just put a new wrapper and assume that people are going to accept it. But there's no way of accepting it if your basis are not, if your foundation is not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was an attempt for Indo-futurism. I think we wanted to do a lot more, just in terms of everything, like, you know, design and concept and, you know, just philosophy as well. But this was sort of our first step into this sort of space for India.
You just touched on my favorite aspect of the show, which is just how fully realized the world is, from like the production design to the costume design. And I wanted to ask you guys how you approached that, because I just, like, my jaw was on the floor when we started watching this show. I was just like, oh my God, every corner of the frame, they have thought through this world. And there are both like jokes hidden in every corner of the frame, as well as just like, again, this commitment to this world that they've created and this future that they've envisioned. And it just like, it completely sucked me in. So I'm very curious on how you guys, you know, set about doing that, approached the production design and the costume design and just all of these things that would create this fully formed world for us.
The logos for the cyber cops and things, like, you don't see them very closely, but you can see like, oh, that's kind of the key to different sort of aspects of the job. And like that detail is great.
It's easy as a viewer to take that kind of work for granted, but, you know, so much science fiction has become really kind of cold and flat and kind of, you know, you were talking about that maximalism, like it's gone really minimalist. I find like the Christopher Nolan, I like Christopher Nolan, but the Christopher Nolan stuff is like, it's a lot more minimalist. But here,
it looks like an Apple store,
you know, to put all of that in the frame. So can, if you could tell us about the production and costume design, we'd really love to hear about it.
So when we, you know, started designing the world, I think our basic philosophy also came from comparing two films, one being 2001 A Space Odyssey and the other being Solaris. Both, you know, have pretty much the same narrative, you know, the philosophy is also more, I'm sorry, the story is the same, like both go to a space station, both are exploring new planets, but both of them have like an extremely different treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the treatment from where they're coming from which countries they're coming from. You know, Solaris is from East Europe. It's from Russia. So when, you know, Tarkovsky made it, he said that if space travel became such a common thing, then it makes sense that, you know, the design of the spaceship should be like a beaten, rundown bus stop, and not, you know, a Mac store, an Apple store, for example. It should be like that. Whereas you see Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey, it looks like it's keen. It has like very high design. It's extremely stark. So those two worldviews of those filmmakers came through their work. So I think that sort of you know, that approach led us to how you know, our basis of Indo-futurism, or how design or costume, everything would sort of work in Oki Computer, because we wanted it to be rooted in where we are coming from. So for example, you know, the robots, it made sense for us to use robots that were a continuation of this Godrej cupboard. So there are these metallic cupboards that you see in almost every other house in India, at least while we were growing up. So using that metal aesthetics to make a robot, or using objects that are existing all around us. Like we have these very weird fiberglass penguins and weird wild animals as dustbins.
Those are real.
Those are real. You've seen them.
About that.
So the idea was to use that, upcycle it. So it became, contextual. That's one thing that we sort of discuss also, like how we love Seinfeld also, and we keep like cracking on Seinfeld. But there's so many references that we just don't know of. Like, I mean, only if you're in New York, you might get almost all the references, but it's still really funny for us. It's still something that we really like. So we were hoping that that would also apply to us, that we have a lot of pop culture and allusions and, things that we really wanted to put in the show, which would hopefully appeal to Indian audiences and, have that sort of sense of connection. But at the same time, internationally also have that sort of, would not lose its charm internationally as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we were trying to place it on the map of how this show would look and sound, we really relied on all of our favorite stuff. So like Pooja said, Seinfeld, there was 30 Rock and Community. All of these references informed what would happen in our episodes. And then we also looked at world cinema. We looked at the works of Jacques Tati. Again, because Jacques Tati's work relies so much on interaction with space and the humor and absurdity that emerges from that interaction. So we knew we wanted those things. We knew that we wanted to create a maximalist piece of work. And that eventually meant that, we looked at something like Arrested Development, and in that entire trajectory of a season, you'll find that Tobias has left blue-colored fingerprints on a refrigerator somewhere.
He blew himself so he didn't rub off on anyone later.
Exactly. So that idea stuck with us, because in so many episodes where you wouldn't see Tobias, you'd still see the blue finger marks. You'd see that his hair was, his scalp was, his body was rejecting his new hair follicles, and you'd experience those B and C stories even in episodes that didn't really feature them. So we wanted to create that in costume and in design, and we were extremely excited about doing that painstaking work. I would say I was more excited about that than some of the bigger stuff. It's because I wanted people to look at the fake packets of chips that we created, or the fake soda brands that we created, and go, oh, look, could that be real? Is that something that I could buy at the store? And we had a great time coming up with absurd names for those things. And the hope really was that that people would notice this, and people would maybe freeze a frame and zoom in and see that, oh, there's a thing sticking out there, and that might be an Easter egg or whatever. It was just an interesting piece of trivia. So it's just really looking at some of our favorite sitcoms and so, some of the greatest classics of world cinema and design, and marrying it together and making this strange chimera, because it's a strange, unique, really alien animal to have Jacques Tati and Tina Fey and Seinfeld all living together in a piece of work. But we were so it seemed so fulfilling to do that, and it felt so reassuring to see that, and it was making the team laugh, it was making the designers laugh, and it just constantly felt like it was the right thing to do.
And we also sort of use a lot of architecture, because like that's one thing that I think, we sort of miss in our sort of industry in India, that we don't really communicate with other streams or other fields and, have that conversation through art and culture as well. It works in silos, and it works sometimes in corrupted silos. So we wanted to, marry as many, sort of streams as possible. So we worked with a lot of architects also. So most of the spaces, that we did use were, they're like the finest contemporary architects from India. B.V. Doshi, who won the Pritzker Prize last year. So he was one of the architects who sort of gave us his space. So the Gufa, the dome-shaped space where Satoshi was
the
living.
The
mausoleum. So that's designed by him and this very famous painter, M.F. Hussain.
Is it graffitied in real life too?
Yeah. That's so it, it's a collaboration between a painter and an architect. So it's a gallery, it's a museum, and MFSN painted himself on the walls. So it's a really interesting story, which one should hear at some point. So that was the intention, to sort of bring in the architecture, and it's really sad, but we don't have that sort of conversation going on in India. Like, what we sort of always discuss, Neil and I, is that when you're in Europe or when you're in America, you can walk into, there's a small lane, and you'll walk into a gallery holding like the finest artists in the world. We miss that. We miss buildings. We miss art. Getting that is a work of effort, So we wanted to bring that to the masses. Like, we wanted to make it like this exists in India, this is possible in India. So we really had that sort of driving factor also, in the show. So we really wanted to make it detailed, bring in artists, bring in architects, bring in designers, make it maximalist for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's such a feast for the eyes.
Well, I was going to ask about the architecture, because you probably don't know anything about where we're from, but it's very cold here. And also, we had the most money in the 70s. So our kind of downtown and university areas are very based on brutalist architecture. And I thought that the police station and the Hall of Justice and the kind of corporate headquarters were all kind of concrete brutalist kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We have that here because it gets down to minus 40. But I was wondering, like, what is the sort of practical use of brutalist buildings in India where it's so hot? Does like the concrete keep it cool, or how does that work? Do you know?
The worst design choice to go with, actually.
Oh, okay.
So I'm also an architect. So I've professionally studied architecture. So obviously I'm into architecture heavily. But it's weird because India, while becoming the sort of modern India, just post independence, when after British sort of left the country, India started taking in a lot of their ideas and references from Russia. So even our constitution is almost, we've adopted a lot of socialism from Russia, which also meant the cinema from Russia, which also meant the architecture from Russia. So that way brutalism came along with that. And the other thing is that when the first few our prime ministers, when they started building this wall, because it just opened up, right? The entire country sort of opened up, the nation opened up. They invited a lot of architects. So Corbusier was a huge thing here. So B.B. Doshi was Corbusier's sort of protege. So Corbusier designed Chandigarh, which is an entire city designed by him. Louis Kahn's work is also in Ahmedabad. So all these people, all the masters of the West, also came to India to sort of create work. Moshe Sabdi also made some buildings in Chandigarh. So it's sort of, I don't know how it sort of became a lineage, to use brutalism and concrete in that way. And that sort of permeated even now to contemporary architects. They have different ways of like sort of making it sustainable, like Gurjeet Mathur's Cybercell, the Cybercell we've used.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely concrete, but they have this steel sort of roof, just protecting the concrete from heating up.
Okay.
In that way, they've made it sustainable, and they have a long pool which sort of cools the office. So it's a really weird, it's different in India, because we have vernacular architecture, we have traditional architecture, and that's something that we also wanted to do, like create these visual scapes. So whenever we see institutions, it's brutalist and it's concrete. Whenever we see homes, it's more like these heritage houses where it's painted and where it's more warm. So it's sort of that dichotomy that we live in. So we also wanted to sort of represent it in our visual style.
It's weird how brutalism came around. Like, it was supposed to be futuristic in the 60s and 70s, and then it became super dated, and now it's kind of feels futuristic again. My American history teacher told me that Edmonton is where brutalism came to die. And he's probably right. But it makes me feel kind of like, It feels like home, a brutalist landscape, which is weird, but it always feels very familiar to me.
Yeah, though we're in the process of tearing down all these buildings.
Oh yeah, we don't keep anything longer than 50 years here, but that's something that it's always interested me about India, is that Canada, at least white settler colonial Canada, here in Alberta, the province has only been around since 1905. So the oldest building in town is maybe, I don't know, 120 years old. But in India, you have buildings that are, you know, hundreds of years old next to, you know, a cell phone store or like the most ephemeral sort of stuff. And I think your show definitely plays with that dichotomy really well. You get like the compound of the anti-tech cult, and, you know, they look like they live in like just a colony like you would have normally. But then you get like the cyber cell, right? So can you talk a bit more about the anti-tech people? Because they're definitely absurd, but they're not that far off from some anti-scientific types we hear about all the time, specifically during a pandemic. You know, there's definitely people right now who are not that far away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially during calamities like COVID or even during cyclones or whatever, they just seem to crawl out of the woodworks. But yeah, they're everywhere. We took inspiration from a lot of people that existed in India and that existed elsewhere. With all this talk of vaccinations and of 4G and 5G technology, these people were always around us. So we were spoiled for choice. It was like a buffet of just aggressive. An aggressive lack of intelligence. So there was a lot to pick from, but at the same time, we wanted to do some justice to the people in terms of what they were saying and what they were thinking. Not that what they were saying or thinking was rational, but we wanted to construct a rationality for them that was consistent for where they were coming from. So that's why the idea of just a character who says that. You know, his three or four previous generations have been ruined by the progress of technology. First it was mechanization and then industrialization. Now there's a fourth wave of artificial intelligence. So we did want to create that as an origin story for a supervillain who's rooted in anti-vaccines and those kinds of repressive ideas. But at the same time, they had to make sense of what they were saying. They had to be authentic and real. The instinct was to create embodiments of arguments. We wanted there to be a voice that stood for artificial intelligence and stood for science. We wanted a voice that was still trying to figure out what the future course of humanity would be. And then a completely off the rails kind of a voice that just wanted the random annihilation of all progress. So we were very excited about creating an entire sort of robust spectrum of arguments that would reflect present day India and present day wherever, you know, whether it's Canada or the US. And for those people to fight and clash with each other and in their interaction figure out where the hell they're going to go and how do we bring everybody along. Mm-hmm.
They reminded me of the Neo-Victorians from Neal Stephenson's The Diamond Age, if you've read that book. Kind of regression. Oh, technology is scary. I'm afraid of a Jeep. Like, I'm just going to put a weird cloak on and never use my phone. It's not like technology is going to go away. You're just going to be a Luddite, which is fine, but you know, you're deliberately pulling yourself away from the world.
In India, it's also weird because I mean, of course, Luddites exist everywhere, but in India, at some point, technology gets appropriated into religion as well, which is a very weird thing to happen, you know, because it's almost hypocritical. So
text your guru for, you know, such and such alms and that kind of thing. So you spoke earlier about how you find that a lot of Indian science fiction kind of falls back on mythology and stories. I'm also thinking of how that has been done in the West, too, with Roger Zelani's Lord of Light or Grant Morrison's, what was that called, 29 Days, his retelling the Mahabharata, but with superheroes, basically. Right. But I do kind of find that Ajib is sort of worshipped. Like he's like a figure that people do think of as a deity. And I wonder if you could go a little bit more into that, because he's kind of a fascinating part of the story. Everyone else you kind of understand, but we've never actually seen anything like Ajib in real life. And that would change everything, right?
Oh, also, is he named after the famous automaton? Because I read about the famous automaton after we recorded the episode, and I was like, I bet that's where the name came from.
Yeah, that was a strange revelation because we had written Ajib's character years and years ago. And 2 years after writing the character and figuring out the name, we realized that there had already been an automaton called Ajib.
Okay.
It was a really late discovery. And when we had, it was also interesting because when we had first come up with that character, it was also a chess-playing robot. It was a robot that had been used. That had been appropriated by a chess player to cheat at a tournament. That was the first iteration of that character. So it was a really strange coincidence to go to Wikipedia. Somebody sent us a Wikipedia link and it was just like a weird mind-bending kind of a...
It was not a real automaton. It was like a guy pretending to be a... Anyways, when I read about it afterwards, I was like, oh, I wonder if that was a coincidence because...
It's spontaneous creation.
Amazing. It's lined up so perfectly.
Yeah, just collected consciousness in the air.
Really, Ajib was out there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, India is really weird because, I mean, there's this one story also we keep talking about. In Rajasthan, some place in North India, there was this child prodigy doctor. So at a very, very young age, he became a doctor at like 12 or 13 or something like that. And he sort of narrates this. So he had an interview where when he sort of became world famous when he got his doctorate.
MBA. I think with Oprah. He talked about this with Oprah.
Yeah. So then he said that in India, it's weird that in his village, people would come and worship him and like treat him as God, but would refuse to take medicines from him or take a scientific knowledge from him. So it's your religion gets any scientific progress gets, it's easier to worship someone as a god as deity than take it as a scientific breakthrough. So we live in that kind of world, which is why Ajib made sense. Yeah, so in India, it's I think people, if Ajib would be created, if an algorithm and AI would have been conceptualized in India, it would make sense that people worship it as a deity and less as a technological sort of breakthrough. And we also wanted to, dwell on the idea of free will, because that's our... holy grail. That's our, the ethos of our century, right? We have the idea of free will, the idea of liberty, the idea of freedom, that we as individuals, our justice system is made by that idea that we all have free will. How before it used to be the church or it used to be religion. Now it's the idea of humanity that has sort of overtaken it. So we wanted to bring the idea of what does that mean in terms of, even with us. Like, it's easier to bring these questions up when it's not our species, when it's something else, when it's something devoid of us. So we can ask these questions for someone else and then in turn sort of come to that realization or that awareness ourselves. So we wanted to bring the idea of what if you create this sentient being, this conscious being, but this sentient being has desire. What do you do then? Is liberty, should you like allow this person to be, allow this robot to be the way it, let it sort of live its life, or do you bring it back and say that no, it's to the service of humanity? So then what is free will for us then? I mean, like, should we do we have, is it justified for us to have desire, or is it justified for us to have the trappings of evolution and biology?
I think in some ways it's also I think at the center of it is just the it's a matter of science communication for me. I think just the chasm between scientific progress and the people who may benefit from that scientific progress is so wide that information just gets lost. That old quote that sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, that so often manifests in places like India because there's an entire bulwark between people and between whatever's happening in Silicon Valley or even in India, in Bangalore. It's so opaque that people are more willing to believe that works, that just scientific progress is just something that is conjured up, especially in places where, even basic education can't be afforded to people. scientific progress can take on really, really strange proportions and dimensions. Like Pooja is saying, like the child prodigy was treated as a god. It was easier for people to believe that it was a miracle. It was a divine manifestation than the fact that it was a child prodigy. So often information just gets sort of escapes into a magical, mythical realm. And I think that was also the instinct that early filmmakers and artists tried to capture, because science fiction seemed made up. It seemed that going to the moon was an act of mythical proportion. It didn't seem like something that human beings could do. And so much of science fiction was just a leap from that. If your baseline is that, then you can just, you know, build an entire universe of myth. So I think, and that gap closes as you go west from India. That gap between scientific progress and just the people who are going to receive that information, that chasm sort of narrows down. But in India, it seems like it widens with every year, every passing year it widens. Right now, we have a guru who's trying to peddle, strange concoction as a cure to coronavirus while trashing allopathic or what they call Western medicine. And it makes no sense. It's easily verifiable. It's easily it's demonstrably stupid. The idea that this guy has come up with a cure for coronavirus somewhere alone in an ashram. That idea is laughable, but there's a lot of people who are embracing that idea. It's because that science is so poorly understood. It's because that science hasn't been communicated enough to people. It hasn't been repeated enough to people. It hasn't been verified. That's why this keeps happening, whether it's anti-vaxxers or people who believe that babas can cure COVID or babas can cure cancer or whatever have you. I feel like that's at the center of it. That's at the center of all of this.
I was just, even what you're saying is right, but also at the same time, I feel like India is so weird. Like, there's that story of, so there's this documentary filmmaker called Anand Patwardhan, and he's made a series of documentaries where he goes to villages and talks to people about a lot of things, from, you know, religion to, you know, caste, or to, you know, just a lot of movements and, you know, like protests, everything. So he is in this one village where there's this very old, frail lady who's sort of lying on the bed, and this documentary filmmaker is having a conversation about God, that does God exist or not exist. And she comes from this belief that, of course, God exists, and it's there's irrefutable proof that God exists. So he asks her that, what is your proof? So she brings up a photograph of a representation of a God that's, you know, you get on calendars. So it's like a photograph, it's like a painting or an illustration or a sort of like a cheap photograph of a person dressed up as God. And she believed that that's God. And she's like, you know, you see the technology that you're holding, that camera, that can capture God. So she believes that, you know, technology can capture, you know, something that's invisible. So science can sort of work in these mysterious ways, which is why I find India's, you know, this fascinating sort of bed of like understanding what this relationship is, because you have, you know, these people in one end where you're talking about they're completely against technology, and at the same time, you have people who are sort of co-opting it in a very weird way.
Yeah, it's, I think you also picked the funniest job that a super genius robot would want to do, and it would piss everybody off.
Well, now
it totally makes sense.
Now I assume it must come from your love of Seinfeld. That's why he wants to be a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, here's the thing about airline food. I'm a robot. like it, being a stand-up comedian is potentially like the least useful profession there is, and yeah, everyone in the world would be annoyed at this if our super robot, who was supposed to fix everything, did that. It was a real kind of like Futurama bit, I think. Like that would totally happen, yeah. And we would all get annoyed by this. But do you want to talk about his comedy career, such as it is? Because I think that's one of the things that sets this apart from any other sort of depiction of a robot I've seen. Because
I sometimes called him like Good Bender.
He is kind of like a good version of Bender. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that? Because I've never seen a robot try to be a comedian before. And You know, yeah. Arguably, I still haven't seen one, so his jokes are okay, but they are the sort of thing that an AI would, like, insert humor module. Okay, this is a joke that's been synthesized from many hundreds of jokes.
Yeah.
Actually, that was really the genesis of the whole show. The entire series started with the silly notion that what if a computer could tell jokes? And I feel like we structured the series as a sketch, as a Key and Peele sketch, if you will. That it's just an escalation of an idea that's absurd at its core, and then let's see where we can take it. And as we built on that, we realized that it was making a little bit of sense to us as we went along. It made sense that the idea is laughable because we can't imagine computers doing anything emotional, humor being the most mysterious out of everything. A computer might be able to mimic joy or sadness or whatever, because there you can identify the moving parts for those emotions. But humor is something that's really complex that we don't probably fully understand yet. So that idea seemed complex, and we felt that there was so much conflict and complexity and strangeness in that idea that we could use it and run with it. And it was such a fertile ground for creating this character out of that. And then as we started doing that, of course, we knew that we were making a comedy. We were influenced by amazing sitcoms that had influenced us, whether it was Seinfeld or even just George Carlin's work. We wanted to see how we could create an interloper in a society like India, who's just constantly calling people out on their rubbish. And of course, who gets annihilated for it, who gets destroyed for it, and the career trajectory of something that starts off as a savior and then ultimately falls from grace, and this becomes this strange, washed up shadow of its former self. That seemed really exciting for us. The idea that a comedian could be the savior of us all, of human civilization, seemed like an endlessly fascinating and absurd idea. And again, in India, it's an interesting time to be in India, because if you look at a lot of the dissent against the present administration that's emerging from India is coming from comedians. Our comedians are some of the most outspoken people in civil society. It's been a strange journey. It's been the jobs that politicians are supposed to do, the people who've been tasked with calling the government out or holding them accountable has been outsourced to comedians. So comedians have just taken up that mantle. They've been endlessly sort of subjugated to constant harassment for it as well. We've had comedians go to jail, spend months and months in jail for putting out a tweet or making a completely silly joke about the Prime Minister or about any of the other people running the show. It became an interesting exercise for us, because comedy seemed to be the finest expression that we had at our disposal for dissent. The idea of capturing that inside a robot, that a robot is choosing to express itself through that medium, seemed really interesting and very relevant for our time.
And also historically, you know, the idea of a joker or a fool was the one who could, like, criticize the king or the kingdom, right? Because any king, any sort of court would have the court jester, who was the only one who could say like really outrageous things and not be beheaded. So the fool or the joker has always sort of played that sort of role as a critique to society, as the one who sort of holds the torch and holds the light to, you know, the injustices that happen. So we wanted to make that as, you know, the central premise also as the comedian. And the other thing was also that, like Neil was saying, that humor is so, it's the most evolved out of all, you know, consciousness elements, like from anger, jealousy, greed, laughter, you know, all of those things. Laughter is the most evolved. Like a lot of, like even in other species and other animal species, who else cracks jokes or who else laughs? It's a very, very evolved thing. It's that emotion is very evolved, and the idea is also again like because we were talking about what makes anything conscious, what makes anything sentient. So you need to sort of break down what does consciousness entail. What is it? Empathy? Is it agency? Is it a desire? What encompasses true intelligence or true consciousness? So we thought that humor is that sort of pinnacle, because to understand, I mean, you need so many things to understand humor, right? You need foresight, you need to understand patterns. And once that pattern is broken is when humor arises. So having all those sort of, it felt like a very complex thing, emotion to sort of, for a robot to have. And if a robot has that, then chances are it truly could be conscious. So that was also one of the reasons why we thought that it makes sense for Ajit to be a comedian, even if it's a bad comedian. The fact that he understands jokes, or like can crack it, that's what makes it special. And then of course all the satire and the political torch it sort of lights on it, that's added, of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard enough for, like, we're all humans, but to understand Indian humor is almost beyond us in a lot of places, because there's a language barrier and cultural barrier. But I thought Ajit was funny. Like, it's like he did transcend to everyone. He was funny in a way that everyone understood. But it's
not because his jokes were good.
Not because his jokes were good, but like just his general way of being was funny. And
I love him.
His interactions with Vijay Varma especially were like, that was probably my favorite part of the show. That kind of odd couple, like alien nation sort of linkage between a guy who just hates robots and a robot who just wants people to like him so much.
And Radhika Apte is so tender towards him this way.
Yeah, she keeps trying to help him out. But we're getting close to an hour here, so I just got a couple last little questions. So what is it about Goa that you wanted to use it as the setting for the show? Because typically, from our perspective, Goa we see as the sort of
vacation place.
The vacation place, the party place, but also you get the sort of Portuguese leftovers, something like Guzarich or something, where you've got kind of these colonial leftovers, and it's different from sort of the British colonial leftovers. It's got an interesting fever to it, and I'm wondering if maybe that sort of collision is why you pick Goa, but just maybe let us know what that was about.
So, I mean, one thing that we sort of did, for the show was we used a lot of tropes. So we wanted, because we knew that the idea is dense, in the end we are talking about AI laws and policy. So it's a dense topic for, just regular moviegoers or, people who watch the show. So we wanted to sort of, put it in a pill that was comfortable, put it in something that wasn't easily, more like easily acceptable and more like comforting to sort of see. So we used the idea of the murder, the murder mystery, the form of like a detective, a noir detective sort of murder mystery where all this is unfolding. And in noir films or like a lot of these detective films, it's really interesting when they go to like a really offbeat small town place in, in some backwater somewhere, or like the Florida backwater or somewhere. It goes to some very quaint place where it seems unlikable that a crime like this could sort of happen. So we wanted to use that kind of trope as also that, the idea of like Goa being this sort of quaint coastal town where it seems unfathomable that such a crime could occur. So we wanted to use that trope. And it also made sense for us in terms of the show, because we wanted to create a sort of an alternate universe, an alternate world. So we ended up using a lot of different cities in India, and we amalgamated into one fictional space called Goa. And we wanted to have both those, the world, because like in most science fiction films and most science fiction stories, the city is as much as a player as, the characters are, like, there can't be Batman without Gotham, the Gotham City. So most of these things work in conjunction. So we wanted to retell the idea of and retell the story of how Goa could be consumed in pop culture.
So it's kind of like in Neuromancer, those books, how the Eastern U.S. is turned into the sprawl. Yeah. So it's not Goa as we understand it. It's Goa plus a bunch of other sort of places around it. Okay.
Well, and I think that's why you and I, Matt, had such a kind of post-cyberpunk feeling from the show because of the way that it's blending science fiction and noir. And I thought it was so smart to set it up as a murder mystery. I was thinking about this the other day. There's this comic book series that Matt and I read when it was coming out called Fables, which is like envisions this idea that all of the like storybook characters that we all grew up loving all like live in exile in New York. And the series gets like, it gets wild. Like it just kind of spirals into like creating this bigger and bigger world. But the very first story arc is a murder mystery because murder mysteries, people understand them. And so it draws you in. And I felt a very similar thing in watching OK Computer where it's like, I know noir, I know murder mysteries. And then I got drawn into this, you know, this very bizarre, over-the-top amalgamation of genres that just kept throwing, like, every episode I was like, here's another philosophical idea to grapple with. And it just, like, I think using familiar genres made it really kind of easy to get into. And then by that last episode, you know, just floored.
But,
just
like,
floored.
Detectives also, it's their job to go to people's houses and ask them questions. So it's a great way to learn about the world because, you know, some annoying guy comes to your house like, hey, where were you?
Yeah.
What's that? Who's that? What's going on here? Like, that's been a classic way of sort of giving us a look into interesting worlds. And also that, you know, especially with noir characters, the main character is usually fairly existential as well. Comes from the French stuff.
Yeah.
Just, oh, why am I alive, etc. So it works really well.
It's that Blade Runner element.
Blade Runner.
We had a deleted sequence from episode one, I think, where Mona Lisa does go around the city in Goa asking questions. And again, that was structured like a sketch because she can't find answers. So with each visit to a new house, she escalates what she brings to the house to show. Because it starts with a photograph, it goes to a big poster, and then eventually in the third part of it, she just brings the dead body to ask the house if they can identify the body, because she simply can't get any answers. That was the instinct behind it, that it's a sketch, it's a funny idea. It's stupid, it's absurd, but you also get to see Goa and its citizens. And also the idea that, just Chinatown and how it's just like, it's Chinatown Jack. We wanted to capture that, but for Goa. There's a great documentary called Los Angeles Always Plays Itself.
Oh, yeah.
And just it speaks so much for the city as a character. And I think that we don't do enough justice to our cities. We don't expose them enough. Like what Pooja was saying about architecture, there's so much architecture that we don't even know exists in India. The pyramid building, for example, the headquarters of the corporation, oddly enough, that's a literal monument to Gandhi. It's a museum built in Gandhi's honor. It's the strangest thing because it's exactly what Gandhi wouldn't have wanted to represent him. It's completely excessive. It's a profligate sort of exercise. But people didn't know that it existed in India. It's like 600 kilometers from Bombay. So we wanted to take the idea of Goa Always Plays Itself and subvert it and show people a completely new Goa.
Yeah, it almost makes me think of the film Shanghai, where the idea of Shanghai is this, what do they call it, like an economic development space where there aren't rules anymore and you could do whatever crazy tech stuff you want and not worry about that. And they wanted, it was in like an imaginary city in the movie Shanghai, that they wanted to make that city into a Shanghai. So a Goa is also a place where, you know, tech can run rampant and, you know, human rights can be trampled on as long as you're making enough money. So yeah, Chinatown example makes sense too.
Yeah.
So, quick lightning round question. Which is your favorite robot? I could say mine was the Chaiwala robot. She seems very personable and easy to get along with and very helpful. But which is yours?
I like the little chicken who's making bets.
Yeah, the chicken who's keeping an eye on everything.
I think that would be mine as well. I think the rooster would be mine.
Yeah, I think it's the same. I do like the welcome bot, the rooster bot the most. Because, that's one thing I really wanted to do, get characters, every robot should have some quirk or should have some other life going on. And, it's as much a story of, we keep thinking of it as a coming of age story of robots, because it is a coming of age for Ajib, it's a coming of age for, Moshiba, the Chaiwala bot. Mm-hmm. It's a coming of age for the welcome, for the rooster bot. So it's a coming of age for every single machine.
Well, they've expanded beyond their jobs. Like, if the welcome bot was supposed to welcome you to things, she probably wasn't programmed to be like a neighborhood watch bot who's suspicious of everybody. And the Chaiwala bot, they use her to block Vijay Varma into the back room so he can't get in, can't do his job because he hates robots so much. My favorite joke in the whole show is that his parents were DJs, and that joke was just sort of outsourced to robots, because basically a robot could be a DJ now, but that would make you very angry at robots.
That's true.
What character do you think, because they all have sort of different perspectives on everything that's going on. You wanted to give us this dichotomy between everybody. But who is closest to your own sort of opinions about what should happen with AI and robots and the future? Who do you think would be not the author insert character, but the one that you agree with the most?
I think for both of us, I can speak for both of us. It's Lakshmi's character, Radhika Apte's character, because we are both very pro-technology and we do think, there is a lot of hope there. So we are closest to her for sure.
But I think just in terms of what character I would like to see and what character I had the most fun with, I would say it was Vijay's character, because for me, it's like Humphrey Bogart transposed to, the 21st century and has to contend with these endless idiosyncrasies. That seemed like such a funny thing, that this straight and narrow, hard-nosed cop who has to somehow deal with a flamboyant assistant, a Chaiwala robot, and other disaffected members of the cyber cell and solve this damn murder. So that was always a fun thing to do.
Sorry, I was saying that it also makes more sense for a story that, the story is said from the perspective of someone who absolutely is disillusioned by AI than tell the story from a person who was already in love with it. So philosophically, we agree with Lakshmi, but of course, as a story, a narrative choice, it makes more sense to go with someone like Sajan.
Well, yeah, because we don't have that level of AI in our world. So Lakshmi, since she's completely on board with it, we don't understand her yet. We haven't seen all these robots, but a guy who hates robots, that's not that far off. We can understand that. It would be kind of annoying to have all these robots around, especially if they took your parents' job. I think my other favorite guy is the young Sika officer who has to moonlight as a robot delivering food, and he keeps having all these physical problems, and he seemed the most relatable to me. Just kind of a hard done by guy, and his job isn't that secure, so he's got to find other employment. That seems very topical as well.
I just love Mona Lisa.
Oh yeah, Mona Lisa was fantastic.
I love her so much.
She's a revelation, really. What's next for you guys? Are you working on another season, or what's next for the world?
I don't know. We have a lot of ideas. We ended up putting a lot of ideas also on this show, and we wanted to keep that as a jumping board for a more and more, this was absurdity toned down, and we really held on to it. So we really want to sort of go, more all out. The next thing we do, even if it's OK Computer or something else, we really wanted to, it'll be conceptual. Again, it'll be, philosophical, of course. But at the same time, we want to step up everything, world building and philosophy and, the narrative. And we want to make it more quirky, for lack of better word.
at the moment, we don't know if there is going to be a season two. But I mean, we're really excited. We've been immersed in the world for the last 6 years, so there's a lot more to come if it were to happen. That's extremely exciting. And like Pooja said, it's a conversation starter. We were sort of also testing waters with this one because it was like starting from scratch. So we had to lay a lot of groundwork to be able to begin. So the next season, if it were to happen, would be even more exciting just because now we can get at some of the hardest stuff and really, really exploit that.
Yeah, I really felt like that the last episode leaves it open to so much possibility. Like I love that last episode, just kind of how all these ideas come together and come through. And I'm excited for more. I hope there is more. This is, I think, you know, easily one of my favorite projects I've seen out of India in recent years. So I hope there's more.
And maybe like side stories and stuff too. I could see a comic book in the background. Kind of like a crusading reporter trying to figure out what's going on. So like Transmetropolitan or something.
Yeah.
That'd be another good way to expand the universe, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. We actually did, in the run-up to make this happen, there were countless sort of tangential journeys that we took. So there was a graphic novel, there was an entire pilot for an animation series, because it so easily lends itself to something like that. There's been countless sort of these meandering explorations before even arriving at this.
Yeah, and we also thought of the show almost like a sort of origin story for all of the characters. So it's like you, almost everyone has a character transformation, and then they are set up the Luddite character, the Jackie's character, Pushpak. He walks away into the night and you don't know what he's up to, and you already have his history. And then you have Lakshmi's character, Lakshmi, who from someone who really was for AI, and she just starts the civil disobedience movement for robots, where all robots stop working simultaneously. So we also thought of it as a good sort of origin story for each character. And when you already laid the groundwork, like Neil was saying, it's easier to sort of jump off that base for sure, like a company.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're definitely excited to see what happens next, and really looking forward to it. And hopefully this interview and our episode is able to kind of raise the profile of the show, because we really, really liked it and we'd love to see more of it. But thanks so much for coming on. And Neil Pagadar and Pooja Shetty, creators of OK Computer. Oh yeah, do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you, or
online?
Yeah, not in real life.
Your Twitter handles and the like, if you'd like to share.
Yeah, address, I guess.
I don't even remember.
It seems a little dangerous.
Don't want too many anti-vaxxers writing those.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what my Instagram thing is. It's
pooja.move, so you can find me there on Instagram. And my Twitter is _PoojaShetty.
It clearly looks like we're stalwarts of social media. My Instagram is Neil Pagadar, and my Twitter is, I think, at Neil Page. I'm remembering correctly, but yeah, that's where we live.
We'll leave links for them in the show notes. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Bonkink.
I'm Andrew Paul.
And we're the hosts of the Well Endowed Podcast.
The Well Endowed Podcast is produced by Edmonton Community Foundation, or ECF as we call it.
ECF provides grants to charities through the endowment funds we create and manage with our donors.
Hence the title of our show, The Well Endowed Podcast.
Every month, we bring you a collection of stories and interviews with fascinating guests who are working to make Edmonton a strong, vibrant city to live in.
Through these stories, we look at the space where endowments intersect with your communities.
So if you're interested in the people and issues impacting your community, check out thewellendowedpodcast.com.
This episode is brought to you by Park Power, your friendly local utilities provider in Alberta, offering internet, electricity, and natural gas with low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. In Alberta, you get to choose who you buy your internet, electricity, and natural gas from. If you choose Park Power, you are choosing a positive local business. Plus, Park Power shares its profits with local not-for-profits that are working to make a difference for their communities. Shopping local is very important to Park Power's owner, Chris Kozowski. And we love local here at the Alberta Podcast Network, so it's a great fit. Learn more at parkpower.ca.
Thanks again to Neil and Pooja for coming on the show and talking about OK Computer. It's on Hotstar right now, so go watch it. What else you got to do?
I think listeners can tell, we loved the show. We really hope that there's more, and so we encourage everyone to queue it up and watch it. It's really quite a, you know, I mean, it's a very intellectual show, but it's also just full of funny characters and funny moments, and I think is my favorite thing I've seen all year so far. It and Barb and Star.
Two very different things.
Really, yes. And I'm not a comedy person, but comedy is really, really winning the year for me. Mm-hmm. Maybe because everything else going on in the world is too depressing to think about.
Bit of a downer, yeah.
And on that note, we are going to be taking a bit of a break.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be taking a month off because we are going to be preparing for our mid-year review episode. Every year, well, most years, we do a year-end episode and a mid-year review episode. So we cover 6 months of Hindi releases all at once. And our next episode is going to be us discussing the Hindi releases that we've had the opportunity to see from the first 6 months of 2021. Now it's going to be a bit of a different year, as mm-hmm. our last year-end, our 2020 year-end review episode. We also found ourselves in a space where movie theaters have just been closed for the past 6 months.
It's just what we can get at with streaming, because they're still not open here yet.
Yeah, so it's going to be for the most part.
And I don't want to go to the movie theater, honestly. It's dangerous out there.
Yeah, it's going to be for the most part streaming releases, but we're going to need some time to really catch up in our viewing. So that's going to be out in about a month. In the meantime, Matt, how can people keep up the show?
At BollywoodPod on Twitter. I'm at Matt_BOWES. You're at Aaron E. Fraser. Facebook.com/BollywoodsForLovers. Tumblr.com/BollywoodsForLovers. Rate and review us on your favorite platform.
And while you're rating and reviewing us, you can go check out my other show that I do with Paul Matwichuk called Trash Art in the Movies. What did we just discuss? Oh, we just discussed the recent film Nobody, the action film starring Bob Odenkirk, alongside David Cronenberg's A History of Violence. I had a lot of opinions and a lot of thoughts, some good and some bad, about both of those films. So if you'd like to hear that, please go check out that podcast. We'd also like to give a shout out to Becca Dulkey for our artwork. Tuffy continues to be the best boy.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'll see you in a month.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.